David Gross, Kathy P., Matrix Model, Street Filter.
Okay. Micha Burkos from Weizmann, and I'm, well, that's one of the things I'm doing in string cosmology. Another thing is related to resolving singularities in string theory, space-like singularities. Well, the thing I'm going to talk about, any additional stuff that needs to be done, organizers? Okay. Okay, so I'm going to talk about reviving standard model baryogenesis using horizontal symmetries. I should apologize. I mean, this is my first attempt on cosmology since 10 years ago, so it's a little bit rusty. Okay, this is work done in collaboration with Yossi Nir and Tomer Volansky, who's a student at Weizmann. Okay, so this is roughly the outline of the talk. I'm going to remind you what electroweak baryogenesis is supposed to be. The current wisdom in this is that it's kind of close. By close, it's something like 20 orders of magnitude, but it's, you see, many of the elements are very close, but we're not quite making it. We cannot make enough baryons just using the standard model. Now, that relies on using the standard model, but in cosmology we can play various kinds of games, and in particular we can allow large variations of couplings. And in particular, there are actually some experimental evidence that couplings have changed throughout history. Usually, I mean, that's a very tiny variations up to z equals 3 or 4 or something like this. But so it's certainly something that's interesting to think about. Although this specific experimental data is well quite shady.
Data on alpha.
Yes.
That's large.
No, I said that's a very tiny variation over relatively, late periods of the universe, z equals 3, because you look at some quasars or whatever. However, I think it's a very, well, and of course that data is plagued with large systematic errors, which are poorly understood. However, I think it's a very intriguing thing to think about. Okay, so. Well, I mean, there are lots of scenarios for baryogenesis. Leptogenesis is certainly one of the more popular ones right now. I mean, this is not leptogenesis. This is another scenario.
Leptogenesis also has close to
those. Well, I'm not an expert on leptogenesis. My understanding is that you can basically get whatever you want from there. You know, if you tweak enough with the models, I can get as many baryons as I want. I'm not aware of any universal bound. So it kind of works, but it, I would say that it also does not have too much predictive power.
It's less constrained up at the gut scale, so it's right. The electroweak word in there that's a problem.
Okay, so we want to kind of tweak a little bit with the standard model and have its various couplings change with time, but one needs some kind of guiding principle how to do that. And I'm going to use the flavor structure of the standard model encoded using horizontal symmetries in order to arrange this variation of the coupling. So this would give us a new standard model baryogenesis scenario. Then there would be some conclusions.
Standard model, you mean purely standard model? No fields beyond the standard model?
Well, I mean, of course, since I'm varying couplings, I have a field that is varying. I mean, this is the only way I can do it. However, the precise statement, well, the precise statement is encoded here, basically. So when one says that you cannot generate enough baryons in the standard model, there are two ingredients that go into it. Here I'm just referring to one of them. The main suppression factor is that there's not enough CP violation in the standard model. So one needs additional sources of CP violation. What we're going to show is that it's enough to have the CP violation in the standard model in order to generate baryons. That is a three-generation structure with the CKM matrix. And there's a kind of standard suppression factor, which we'll claim can be kind of alleviated in a different way than extending the standard model with additional CP violation sources. Now, the mechanism that I'm going to discuss, well, natural is an issue of taste, but I think we think it's natural in a cosmological setting. That is, there's just a single mass scale M, which is some high scale. I will not explain the hierarchy between M and the scale of the standard model. There is just this single scale, which I'll assume. And otherwise, all dimensionless parameters, which are not standard model parameters that we observe, are of order one. And last, that you can generalize this to various supersymmetric models. And for example, if you try and apply this general framework to the MSSM, you relax a lot of constraints from baryogenesis on the MSSM. So for example, there's a statement in the literature that baryogenesis is kind of pushing the MSSM to some extreme region of its parameter space. That will not be true if you allow, of course, the mechanism that I'll discuss. Okay, so questions? Okay, so you can't have a talk about baryogenesis without mentioning Sakharov's criteria. So there are three basic criteria that need to be satisfied for a theory in order to generate enough baryons, in order to generate baryons at all. One is you, of course, need baryon number violation. The other is the CP and C violation. And last is the departure for thermal equilibrium. Basically, if any of these conditions is not doesn't occur, then I mean it's a three-second argument to show that you generate the same amount of baryons and anti-baryons. Now, all of these basically occur in the standard model, and I'll explain a little bit how. I'm sure most of you have seen that. Now, although all of these occur in the standard model, the problem is that these effects are not strong enough in the standard model in order to generate baryons, enough baryons. So what's the standard model baryogenesis scenario, at least what people would have wanted to be the baryogenesis scenario? So going off equilibrium is generated by the electroweak phase transition, which the wave of the Higgs goes from zero to some non-zero value. And CP and B are violated in the standard model either by explicitly by having some phases or by Sphaleron processes. Now the general picture, and this is the only thing I will need in the discussion. And the general picture is the following. Suppose this is the unbroken phase and this is the broken phase. There is some domain wall between them. Now, as the temperature decreases, this becomes the true vacuum. So actually, this domain wall is kind of expanding into the H equals zero phase with some velocity V. And basically, this domain wall and its motion are what drive the off-equilibrium dynamics. Now, in this phase, Sphaleron processes are not suppressed. They equilibrate B to zero at some rate determined by the temperature. Here, H is different from zero. Sphaleron processes are suppressed, and the baryon number is fixed. Now, there's a lot of detail that go into the dynamics of what's happening here, but very loosely, from in the frame of the wall, there's like a flux of plasma coming in from this direction. There's some complicated dynamics going on inside the wall, and the net result is some baryon number flux that goes into the broken phase, and this number of baryons is fixed since Sphaleron processes are, as I've mentioned, suppressed. Now, this is basically the only information I'll need about the process. It's a rather complicated analysis to compute exactly what's going on here, some off equilibrium thermal field theory, there are some strong coupling issues one usually encounters, etc., etc. But at the end of the day, there are two problems that are kind of generic in this model and are quoted as the main reason that standard model baryogenesis doesn't work. And the two problems are the following. One, any process which relies on CP violation from the Kobayashi-Mascara matrix is proportional to a factor of this type. So there's a product of the difference of the quark masses, the up charm and top, and the three other quarks. Then there's some factor that comes from the KM matrix, which is 10 to the minus 5. It's some combination of the sines and cosine of the rotation angles and the the CP violating phase. Now this is a object of dimension 12 coming from these high powers of the masses. And if you want to try and estimate how much CP violation can occur in a specific process, then you need to identify what's some relevant scale in this process. You need to take this dimension 12 object divided by this appropriate scale to the 12th power. You'll get some dimensionless number, and that kind of tells you how strong CP violation can be in this specific process. So for the electroweak phase transition, the relevant scale is something is roughly the temperature of the phase transition, about 100 GeV. And if you take this guy and divide it by this to the power 12, you get something of order 10 to the minus 19. So already before you started doing anything, whatever result you will get out of the dynamics, this whole complicated mess that happens in the world, the number of baryons would have to be multiplied by 10 to the minus 19.
Yeah, I thought that by now it's established that there is no phase transition or very weak phase transition in the standard model.
We'll get to that in a second. That's suppression factor 2. Now we're in number 1. Because most of the physics would have to go into this discussion. Dealing with the phase transition would kind of be done nonchalantly in half the transparency at the end. Okay, but okay. So the main thing is that there's this suppression factor. Now, the reason that this is so I basically told you what's the result, but the reason is basically that there are very light quarks floating around, and when I divide them by T, and there are lots of them, so when I divide them by T to the power 12, I get a small number. So this suppression is due to the hierarchy of masses in the flavor sector. And what we want to do is play around with this hierarchy structure within the standard model and try and suggest, kind of try and get rid of this suppression factor. Now the second suppression factor is that one needs to be enough of equilibrium. Well, that's not precisely. I mean, there's another criteria, which the phase transition has to be strongly first order enough. Now that implies a certain bound on the mass of the Higgs. Well, the technical meaning of a phase transition being strongly first order enough is that Sphaleron processes have to be suppressed in this size of the domain wall, that is within the broken phase. Now, I'm not going to explain what's the relation between the strength of the phase transition and the mass of the Higgs. However, if you want a strong first-order phase transition, that is, you want Sphaleron processes to be suppressed, and if they're not suppressed, they'll just equilibrate B to zero. If you want this to be strongly first-order, then the mass of the Higgs has to be less than 50 GeV. Now, currently, the bounds on the mass of the Higgs are much higher. They are 114 GeV. For this to work, for standard model biogenesis to work, we want to have mass of the Higgs smaller than 50 GeV. If you're an experimentalist, this is a huge difference. Since we are not experimentalists, we'll know that the difference here is of order 1. So basically, if I take the parameters of the standard model and I tweak with them by changing them by multiplicative factors of order 1, 2 pi's, then I might reach a situation in which the mass of the Higgs is pushed to a regime where the transition is strongly first order enough. Okay, so the standard model kind of has all the ingredients, which is very suggestive, but it doesn't quite do it on a, kind of semi-technical grounds. Well, 10 to the 19 suppression factor is not technical grounds, but you really need to plug in the numbers in order to get that that factor. So we want to see whether we can promote some of the couplings of the standard model to become dynamical fields and arrange some kind of natural mechanism such that during the electroweak phase transition, when the temperature was of order MW, actually these parameters were very, very different than they are today, and maybe we can have enough baryons generated at that period. Okay, so we need to discuss how variation of couplings can be achieved in some kind of sensible way when you couple them to the standard model. So I'm going to assume some scalar field that is coupled to the standard model by some high-dimensional operator suppressed by some high-scale M. So I'll denote this by phi. I mean, when I write these formulas, when coupling to the Higgs sector, I'll assume that phi is charged under some U1. We will later see that phi has to be charged under a Zn in our mechanism. So there would be some additional terms here, but for simplicity, let's write an expression of this type. Now, this is natural from a theoretical point of view. String theory certainly has lots of moduli, lots of fields that can change. As these fields change, they change the couplings of the low energy theory. If you want to discuss effective Lagrangian, then this is also a kind of sensible thing, natural thing to write. If you indeed couple phi to the standard model through some particles of high mass M, and therefore only when you integrate M you induce these terms in the effective actions. And if you want to do some SUSY extension to the standard model, there's only lots of scalars there.
Are you going to tell us what M is numerically?
10 to the 10 GeV. Okay. Well, bounded from above by 10 to the 10 GeV. And there are some bounds from below which we are not sure about yet. But I think they are lower than 10 to the 10 GeV. Yeah. Okay, so M is this single dimensionful high scale parameter that I'm keeping. All the rest, all the other assumptions about these functions that vary the coupling are that, they are generic functions. Their Taylor expansion has coefficients of order one. So I'm cheating. So there's one subtle point, there's one term that you need to worry about, which is a direct coupling between phi squared and h squared without any mass term, which is allowed by the symmetries. I claim that writing it this way, where this is the scale that appears in the standard model, is a natural way. And for example, if you think about this f coming from some one-loop threshold corrections, then this is indeed natural. This scale mu would be some m Planck times some exponentially small factor, and then one-loop corrections that change the coupling basically induce a change of this type. So these types of coupling are kind of natural and expected from lots of theories, lots of different theoretical approaches to extending the standard model. Now, usually this doesn't have, adding these fields don't have too many consequences for the standard model or whatever low theory you have. It doesn't have too many consequences at late enough times. By late times, what I mean is T, which is of order M weak, the scale, scale of the low energy theory, and T is the temperature of the universe. Now, the reason for this is the following, the kind of very rough argument. So the potential for phi, suppose I integrate out all the stuff in this low energy theory and I'm just left with some effective potential for the field phi, then the potential for phi will be of the form mw to the fourth, which is the scale of the low energy theory, times again some dimensionless function of phi squared over m squared. It has to appear in this combination because all couplings scale like phi over m. Now suppose this scalar field is in its true minimal basin of attraction, then this field remains fixed. It can remain frozen far away from the minimum until the Hubble constant goes down to the mass of this field. Now let's plug in the two numbers. We're interested in temperatures of order mw, so the Hubble constant is T to the fourth over m Planck squared, and we can extract the mass. These are all, these should be squares here to match the equation, and we can estimate the mass of this field phi. It's m weak to the fourth over m squared. Now, if I assume that m is much, much smaller than m Planck, which is something I need to assume in order to avoid the moduli decay problem, then the temperature in which this field starts sliding towards its minima is much, much larger than mw. by the time T reaches MW, which is the interesting epoch as far as I'm concerned, phi is very close to its true minima. I will only see very small variations of this field. And of course, that may or may not have consequences, but it's certainly not large variations of the couplings of the standard model. So how do I get large variations of the couplings? Now, the point is that this, the potential itself can change in time, basically. Now, I've shown, I've told you that, in a kind of hand-waving sense, if I want to avoid something like the moduli problem, this field phi has to trace its minima. However, that minima can move around as the temperature changes. So this way I'll try and get some kind of large variation of this field phi in time. So for example, in our case, there's some kind of time-dependent potential for phi, which is this term that I had before, something like the zero temperature potential or something like that. And then I have these additional term where instead of H, some field H, I've basically inserted the vev of H at some at the given temperature T. And this H of T is highly sensitive to the temperature, because H at the phase transition, H of T jumps from zero to some vev V. So this is again the potential. How do I get large variations of the couplings? For T larger than the critical temperature of the phase transition, the only contribution to the potential comes from this first term, because these H's are zero. When T is smaller than TC, then the potential is very different. It gets contribution from all of these terms. And it looks, on the kind of dimensional analysis, something like MW to the fourth times some completely different function of phi squared over M. So what happens is that the electroweak phase transition, the minima of this effective potential can jump. It can jump by a large amount. Well, I mean, by that, you know, one means a change of order one. Phi over M jumps of has a jump also of order one in general. And therefore, the couplings of the standard model, for example, these two dynamical couplings that I've written before, will change by some multiplicative factor of order one. Okay, are there any questions? And this is kind of what we wanted, because the standard model satisfied all of Sakharov's criteria, but the devil was in the coupling. If I can start playing around with couplings, then I can try and get baryogenesis. And we saw that the baryogenesis phase the electroweak phase transition is precisely the period where couplings are supposed to jump. This was based on a very general analysis of what the couplings look like. So it's very natural to try and estimate what's the size of these new couplings at the domain wall and evaluate the amount of baryons that are generated. So that's what we'll try and do. We'll try and generate couplings that are sufficiently different. And the thing we are first going to tackle is, well, okay, so in regards to the phase transition, already at the level of the Higgs potential, I've shown you that I've generated couplings that are different by some order one. So before I tell you what these couplings, I can't exactly, which I cannot determine since I just did a dimensional analysis, there will be a range of couplings for which the transition would be first order enough. However, the thing that's more interesting is to deal with this factor. This factor gave us this suppression factor of 10 to the 19. And we want to see how we can tweak with it such that during the electroweak phase transition, it would be much larger. So one way is, of course, to declare all the masses to be some time-dependent couplings, and you know, but then you kind of lose control. And it's only also not very aesthetic.
So factors of one, I can help you with.
When?
Factors of one aren't
going to help you. Right. So if I just change the masses by factors of one, that will not help me too much. But what I want to do is more radical. Okay. So what I'm going to do, I'll try and link the flavor structure of the standard model to a baryogenesis. Have an efficient way that is based on some potential symmetries of the standard model that will make the suppression factor very large at early times. And I'm going to use the idea of horizontal symmetries. So let me remind you what the Froget-Nielsen mechanism is. I'm going to assume some abelian symmetry, which would be a Zn. And the different generations carry different charges under the symmetry. This symmetry is broken by the VEV of some field phi, which I'll take to have charge minus one, and it's communicated to the standard model by integrating out particles of mass m. So this field phi would basically be the same field phi that I've talked about before. So at this level, I'm not discussing any dynamics of the field phi. It's kind of a way of arranging the flavors, relating the hierarchy between the quark masses to some dynamically broken symmetry. So let's write epsilon equals phi over m. The Yukawa couplings in the standard model now look like expressions of this type. So usually, now all these y hats are numbers of order one. The Yukawas that we currently see are these y hats times these epsilons. Now here I've written the most general terms that are allowed by the Zn symmetry, without any, in a natural Lagrangian, that is all the dimensionless coefficients are of order one, and there's another parameter epsilon, which I need to determine from the quark matrix. However, I know the precise powers of this epsilon based on the symmetry, on the spontaneously broken symmetry. So, for example, if I take charge assignments like this for the various quarks in the standard model, then the effective Yukawas are these numbers, which I cannot determine, time epsilon to some prescribed power, then I can get a matrix of Yukawa couplings and mixing angles for the Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix. Now, I need to go and look at the table from the experiments and see whether there is some epsilon that kind of fits these numbers, and with epsilon equals 0.2, it more or less fits up to coefficients of order one. Now, this is not the only assignment. There are other assignments that that you can do. There would be different assignments if you're doing a supersymmetric theory. This will not make any difference to the framework that I'm going to discuss in a second. This is just a specific example. However, the general idea is what was outlined before. There is some symmetry that is spontaneously broken by some number which, you know, isn't ridiculously small. And that generates the hierarchy between the quark masses.
What scale
is that? This can simply there are two separate questions. One is, what is this parameter M, which is the effective, which controls the couplings? And there is another question, which is, what's the mass of this field? Now, usually in the literature about horizontal symmetries, these two scales are taken to be kind of the same. And that's how you get bounds from flavor-changing neutral cones and stuff like that. So there it's assumed that M is large and the mass of the field is large. Now, what I'm doing in this case, it's different, because if you remember, the potential was M weak to the fourth times some function of phi over m. So the mass is m weak squared over m, which is much lower than that. And the bounds that are quoted there are not quite applicable to this case.
The reason I'm asking is simply because when you're going to read the symmetry, you're going to form the main ones.
Yes.
And how are you going to get rid of these things?
We haven't thought about that very carefully. However, it does not bother the scenario that I'm talking, because the VEV of phi in the unbroken Higgs phase already breaks the symmetry. So at least if I can get you to that point, for example, if the inflaton is charged under this Zn or something like that, so that it picks a specific vacuum, then following from that, I will not generate any additional domain walls during the dynamics that I'm interested in this. But I think it's very interesting, for example, can I argue that the inflaton is necessarily charged under the symmetry? And this would give you, I think, a nice link between the inflaton and the standard model.
What numerically is the mass of this field?
M weak squared over M.
So that's 10 eV?
Well, I mean, the main bound on M comes from... I mean, there's a lower bound on M that comes from flavor-changing neutral currents, which one needs to, as far as we played with it, it seems to be okay. However, I am not an expert on flavor-changing neutral currents. And there is an upper bound on M for requiring that it does not have a moduli decay problem. If M is very, very large and you store too much energy in this field phi, you will never get rid of it. So that gives you an upper bound on M. So there's a window of M whose lower bound is 10 to the 10 GeV, and the lower bound, I think, turns out to be around something 10 to the 7 GeV, but we need to... that's not a solid statement.
And if it's at 10 to the 10 GeV, it's the dark matter?
When? Well, it decays. I mean, the whole point of this was that... the 10 to the 10 bound comes from requiring that it decays to the standard model. Now, you can tweak it such that, you know, it decays, but not fast enough, so there's still stuff of it floating around, but that's not natural. That's highly fine-tuned. Okay, now written in terms of this factor, the CP violation, this mass, this product of differences of masses over the critical temperature, is now epsilon to the 28. And this answers David's question that I will now change epsilon by order one. One? Okay.
Back to this mass, so the mass, if I take 10 to the 10 GeV, it's about an eV. And mm-hmm. This was the mass always, this mass is not changing in time, is it changing?
Well, this mass... receives temperature corrections when the temperature is larger than MW, because its coupling to the standard model also tell you that there could be terms in the effective potential like T to the fourth times some function of phi squared over M squared. However, as T goes down, or T of order MW, the mass stabilizes on this range of masses. There are all kinds of hidden assumptions. I mean, there's some hidden assumption here that if you're breaking supersymmetry, then this is some low-scale breaking of supersymmetry in order not to generate an M SUSY to the fourth F of phi squared over M squared, which would be too large if it's gravity.
Does it have mass of QEV?
Yes.
Then that's a big problem.
Well, if it has energy stored in it. If it doesn't have energy stored in it because it decayed before nucleosynthesis, which is this bound of 10 to the 10, and it's weakly interacting enough with the standard model, then there is no problem. There's a very strong bound on moduli decay.
And what is it decay to?
Photons. If the mass is small enough, which implies that because just as I've changed the coupling, the self-coupling of the Higgs, I also change the 1 over g squared of the photons. There's a 1 over g squared plus some function of phi squared over m squared. I mean, there are issues of photon decay, you know. I mean, there are things I'm confused about, which is the decay of this particle into photons in the plasma, because in the plasma the photons get mass, and you need to start worrying about that. But that's not something we touched.
In the 10 to the minus 19, it was 10 to the minus 5 that came from the Jarlstar factor.
Okay. Yes, yes.
Now, your epsilon doesn't come into that, or does it?
No, it does come in, I mean, because... These S's are...
Facing angles are also powers of that.
Right, right. And I'm assuming a maximal CP phase, so I'm not worried about that. Okay, so basically now we can make baryons in the standard model. So the couplings of this field phi of the Fogart-Nielsen mechanism are precisely what we discussed before of a field that can acquire large variation of its VEV. And therefore, there were different VEVs before and after the electroweak phase transition. After the phase transition, we have to impose the value that we currently see. Before the phase transition, we can't really say, but again, on dimensional analysis, we'll tell you that it's of order one. It can be smaller, it can be larger, we cannot compute. However, if before the phase transition this was the value, then at the electroweak phase transition domain wall, or at least during part of the wall, epsilon was of order one, and what used to be a factor of 10 to the minus 19 is now one. So
when epsilon is one, the masses are all equal?
Yes, of order the top mass, of order the temperature of the phase transition.
The masses are equal, you get zero.
When?
You're not worried about that.
They're all of order is the quark mass, is the top quark mass.
I mean, there are mass differences. Yeah.
Can you say mass of the proton then?
Well, I'm not sure you can talk about the proton at this point.
You want to create baryons, so now you have to redo everything.
Well, I create baryons. There's a baryon number, and after the domain wall, this field phi slides very quickly to the standard model, and you do whatever standard model composites you want to do. Yeah. Okay, so we can estimate the baryon number without really worrying too much about the details of what's happening at the wall. The number of baryons that we see today, the observed NB over S is 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 11. The standard model gives you something which is down by many orders of magnitude. In this scenario, you need to take the standard model prediction multiplied by 10 to the 19, and you get something which is a few orders of magnitude higher than what we require to match with observations.
So presumably that 10 to the 19 is really, you know, between
right.
Epsilon to the 28 and
right.
Epsilon is 1.
Right.
There's a range on the 10 to the 19.
There's a range.
Between 10 to the minus 10 and 10 to the plus 50.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a range here. Yes, I mean, I agree. I can't...
To say it's 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8.
Let's put it this way. I mean, I think...
I mean,
2 to the 28 is a very big number, I agree. However, I would say that if you buy issues of naturalness, then, for example, I don't think I can push this by, 20 orders of magnitude up. That would be...
Well, that's just changing epsilon by one.
Well, it would be changing epsilon by, 5 or something like this.
That's terrible.
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, what can I say? Yes, you're right. Of course, what we're missing is the way of computing this potential. Now, I don't think it's impossible that one would be able to, let's put it this way. If you can probably embed this in, extensions of the standard model which you can compute, maybe you can compute this potential. I don't know, but you're right. We're certainly not claim, let's put it this way, the main claim is that this suppression factor of 10 to the minus 19 need not be there during the electroweak phase transition. Now, had this thing been, 10 to the minus 50, that would not have been enough. However, it is enough in this case.
The numbers on this transparency include the suppression because the phase transition is not strongly first order?
No.
Yes, that's the full answer. I'll get in a second to the issue of the phase transition.
Okay.
Yeah, the factor 28, that's
a good question.
ZN charge assignments?
Yes.
And you say if you mess around with those?
Well, I mean, this 10 to the 19 is not sensitive because this 10 to the 19 is the ratio of the top mass to the masses of the quarks. I mean, basically, in all these models, the charge of the top Yukawa is zero. And therefore, all of them are pushed to the top mass, and that's a universal. I mean, you can...
Does this totally change the
you need to do the
top quark now, which is 20,000 dB.
No, the top mass is the same. I mean, the Yukawa of the top mass is epsilon to the zeroth power. That's actually the only one that doesn't change. All of them are pushed to the top mass.
Okay,
that's
all of these guys.
Right. Okay, so... okay, I'll get to this in a second. I mean, it's much worse than you think. So first of all, I need to tell you that there is a range of M's for this, for which this scenario works. Second, there's an issue of dealing with the standard model phase transition. And since I've changed all parameters that in the standard model by order one or larger, there's a fair chance that this will happen. Now, what are the caveats? So, first of all, it's what David was saying is that we haven't done the computation neither of the strength of the phase transition nor of the details of the wall. This analysis of what's happening in the wall is a total mess. I mean, it's off equilibrium, finite temperature. There are typically strong coupling problems to do with large Yukawas. Here we made all the Yukawas large, so we don't really know how to do this. We're trying to set up the computation, but... I could do the loud in approximation. Okay. If you look at the details, you know, the up and down quarks are treated differently from the top quark because of the ratio of the masses to the width of the domain wall. I mean, there's a very intricate story there, which we are trying to set up, but haven't are very far from completing. However, we did rely on dimensional analysis. I mean, I think we didn't miss any factors of M over M Planck anywhere. And another thing which is milder that you can do, you can ask up to what values of epsilon can I push and still kind of be at the limit of something like the thin wall approximation. So I'm starting to crank up U, and I'm stopping, for example, at the point where the mass of the up and down quark is such that the length wavelength is the same as the thickness of the wall. So how far can I push it and kind of try and pretend that I'm still within the approximation? And we haven't finished that yet, but it seems to give a suppression factor. Instead of 10 to the minus 19, we get 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4, something like that. So already within the approximation, we can kind of test how far we can push it, and we can push it almost to the level of generating enough baryons. Basically the reason is that this epsilon to the 28 goes very, very quickly, much faster than the rate in which you go out of your regime of validity for the thin wall approximation. Yes?
This is harking back to Peter's point, but isn't it a little unnatural to talk about epsilon increasing as a single parameter by a factor of 5, because what you're really talking about is 17 different parameters for them all to sort of
prepare? No, but that's the point of the horizontal symmetry, that arranges all of this stuff into a single large power. Yeah, I mean, it's broken, but you can still use the selection rules from that. Okay, so this is one way in which we can try and estimate whether our dimensional analysis is really kind of okay. Okay, and the other point is what Sean was saying, that we're relying on factors like epsilon to the 28. This 10 to the 19 can certainly change. I would say a few orders of magnitude. Other people will say few is much larger than what.
How heavy is this guy? I think you told. I missed that. How heavy is this guy?
M weak squared over m.
And m is has to be what, smaller than 10 GeV?
Yes.
So you have a field with a mass of an order of an eV, which is reasonably strongly coupled.
It's not reasonably strongly coupled. I mean, the whole point of this m. Well, I mean, reasonably strongly coupled. Let's put it this way: the effective statement.
You said that it needs to decay.
Yes.
Strong enough, so it needs to be. It has some bound below on the strength of cutting. So
yes.
Why wouldn't it be produced in experiment?
Well, I mean, the question is there a bound from flavor-changing neutral currents on this field M?
It's directly produced it.
Observation.
Well, that depends on M, right? That depends on M, the amount of.
It's coupled at current time, like something like an axion with an F axion of order 10 to the 10.
Well, you said small, that's why I'm concerned, because supernova can kill.
Why is
if the mass of the axion is smaller than like KeV or 10 KeV?
Mm-hmm.
You're dead. I mean,
okay.
Well, supernovas
are dead. So not working there.
Okay, you'll have to explain this to me because I'm not familiar with what you can get exactly from these bonds.
Stars.
Okay.
Stars.
Yeah, depends on the dimension of the operator. It uses dimension 5 operator.
Yes.
The
kid, yeah.
Then supernova are pretty much done because the center of the supernova is about an MeV temperature, and this guy is lighter than MeV. So supernova wouldn't have.
Okay. Okay, you'll have to show me the computation exactly, because I'm not familiar with it.
This decays to two photons, right?
This decays to two photons.
So a photon can emit one of these and lose energy from another photon.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that translates into the bound on M. Yeah. Okay, you'll have to show me this, because I'm not familiar with these bounds. Okay, so... let me summarize. So basically, if you combine horizontal symmetries with the dynamics of this Froget-Nielsen in the early universe, you can generate a new biogenesis scenario. And the flavors, and I think the appealing thing here is that if you combine flavor structure and time variation, you would naturally get this scenario. Now, I think it's only one expect that large variations of couplings in this way could provide other interesting solutions to cosmological problems, and I think there's more generally a problem, which is, suppose I get...
The cosmological constant goes like epsilon to the omega.
Yes, that would be good. And there's more generally a question whether you can generate, you kind of need to treat more carefully the bounds that you get from the standard model or any low energy theory from very early time considerations in cosmology. Okay.